From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. The U.S. Supreme Court made some major rulings last week on same-sex marriage and on Obamacare. But if you thought those were the last big decisions this term, think again. Justices ended their term today with rulings on three key issues: lethal injection, political districts, and air pollution. They also decided to take up a case next session on affirmative action. In this hour of Forum, we'll break down those rulings, look ahead to the next term, and explore what it all means for us here in California, and we'll take your questions and thoughts. Wrapping up at the U.S. Supreme Court, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Today marks the end of a very busy, historic term at the U.S. Supreme Court. Same-sex marriage and Obamacare were only two of the big issues on the docket. This morning, justices ruled on life and death matters like capital punishment, on core political issues like how we draw legislative districts, and more. In this hour of Forum, we'll run down what happened today, what it means for us, and what we can expect in the next session of the Supreme Court. We begin with today's ruling on how states draw the political districts that we vote in. Joining us to discuss it is Justin Levitt. He teaches at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Professor Levitt, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chuck.
And here with me in the studio, we have KQED's California Politics and Government editor, John Myers. John, glad to have you back.
Good morning.
Let me start with you, John. What was the controversy?
Well, I mean, this case was really all about drawing congressional districts, and we should make that clear. It's not about drawing California legislature or any other states. It's members of Congress. This is a case out of Arizona, and Arizona has an independent redistricting commission similar to California's. As a matter of fact, California's was somewhat modeled after the Arizona system. And the Arizona legislature said, hey, the U.S. Constitution does not allow anybody except us, the legislature, to draw congressional districts. Case was argued in March. The ruling today was no to the Arizona legislature, that these independent commissions created by voters, and really the Western U.S. has this direct democracy system, California, Arizona, other states, 5-4 ruling, split decision there almost in the U.S. Supreme Court, that the redistricting commission in Arizona is constitutional, that the fact that the voters used their power under the Arizona system to write an initiative and to take that power from the Arizona legislature was constitutional. And that that has a big impact here in California. If it had gone the other way, our political maps could have had been redrawn. As it is, I think the backers of independent redistricting are all celebrating this morning.
This kind of had a lot to do with how you define the word legislature and whether or not legislature is strictly the ones that we elect or whether we the people really are the legislature in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting. I mean, I know that Justin has great thoughts, obviously, as someone who wrote an amicus brief in this case on this. But it was fascinating to me because not every state in America has the direct democracy system where we write laws by initiative. And so the question is the U.S. Constitution was drafted prior to the existence of those systems. And so when it says the legislative power over congressional elections, what does it mean? The people who sit in the building with the dome or the voters at the ballot box? And these five justices said today it should be broadly interpreted. And I think that is not only a victory for people who wanted to see redistricting political maps drawn independently, but also people who look at the power of the voters at the ballot box on all kinds of election issues, which we have changed a lot of in California in the last few years.
You know, Professor Justin Levitt, speaking of that amicus brief, let me turn to you, since I know we only have you and John for a little while. Talk to me about what you wrote in your amicus brief to the court in terms of the way that they should view this question about the way we define legislature and these commissions.
Sure. Well, as John just mentioned, the primary fight in front of the court was about whether the Constitution allowed the states and really the people in the states to decide for themselves who makes the rules. And the court said yes. But there was another issue in the case, and that is, had Congress weighed in? The Constitution says that the way you regulate federal elections is, as a default, left up to the legislature of each state. And as John said today, that included, according to the court, giving the people legislative power when they use it. But that's only default. The Constitution says that Congress can wade in and regulate federal elections whenever they wish. That's why we have federal campaign finance law that applies to all federal elections, no matter what state you live in. And what we tried to present to the court, and which they also accepted in today's opinion, is that Congress also recognized that the people control their legislators and not the other way around. That in 1911, when these sorts of things, as John said, just haven't been around all that often, all that long, and certainly not since the founding, but at the turn of the century in the progressive era when states were changing the way that we make laws, Congress stepped in and said, yeah, whichever way states want to do it is fine. And the court also said that counts, too, that Congress had given this permission to Arizona and to California.
Can you give us some perspective on what this might have meant for other states if the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled against the commission and for the Arizona legislature's case?
Yeah, going the other way would have been a lot of chaos. And the court avoided that chaos today by saying that it's up to each state to decide how they want to regulate federal elections. It's not just commissions like Arizona and California that might have been in the mix. Washington and Idaho, and if it ever gets another congressional district, Montana, use similar systems. Hawaii and New Jersey also have commissions drawing lines. And it's not just about drawing lines either. This was really a case about who has the power to set rules for electing members of Congress. And California's top two system, put in place by a ballot initiative, that was also on the table. If the legislature really means legislature only and the citizens don't have control over the process, then California's top two system and a lot of other initiatives across the country could have fallen by the wayside. The court avoided all of that mess today.
John Myers?
By saying,
yeah, well, I was just going to add to what Justin said about, because I think, you know, it's interesting, Joshua, we're sitting here talking about a ruling. In some ways, it feels like it's less big news because they kept the status quo going. But yeah, had it gone the other way, you would have seen a sprint to redraw California's congressional districts before the 2016 elections. Using census data that's from 2010 that is outdated would have presented legal challenges, would have presented political challenges, because this was a system set up by the California voters. It's popular. And the legislature was going to be thrust back into this to look at these maps, and people would think they would be doing things by partisan manipulation. One staffer in the legislature just messaged me while we were on here who was looking at this and wrote, thank God. He is glad they avoided the political headache that they would have gotten out there in the public had they been asked to wade in, even though some lawmakers would have liked to have done it. I think a lot of people privately were glad they do not have to redraw these districts, that the commission's maps from 2011 are still in place.
And Professor Leavitt, it's worth noting that California and Arizona have two very different kind of political landscapes, but there were politicians kind of on both sides who, as I understand it, looked at this and went, oh, I really hope we don't have to redraw these lines right now.
That's exactly right. As John pointed out, there was the opportunity for some partisan gain if the legislature were able to redraw the lines in Arizona, leaning toward the Republicans, and California leaning much more heavily toward the Democrats. But I think John brought up something incredibly important, which is that even though some of the legislators might have been looking down the road to increase their party's favors, the redistricting process is really a blood feud, and it creates all sorts of bad relationships inside the legislature, as legislators feel, as members of Congress feel, that they are personally being targeted. And so in addition to all of the political awkwardness John mentioned is exactly right, part of the reason that the staffer said thank God is because it turns out that legislators actually don't like this process very much because it is so bitter and so bitterly fought. And this actually allows legislatures in California and Arizona and in all these other states across the country to keep working on actual policy rather than to be sidetracked for a couple months fighting bitterly with each other about where the congressional lines fall.
So is this the end of this fight, or is there any chance that the Arizona legislature could go at this again? Or I mean, is this answering the question, or is there a possibility of another round?
It's the end of this fight, but it's not the end of the fight. There were 218 total cases filed about redistricting for state legislature or for Congress this cycle alone, and we've only got 50 states. There are 30 cases that are still active. None of them are going to proceed on this ground. The court pretty much settled this area, which is good news for everybody. But there's lots of other fighting still to come, including a couple pending cases still in Arizona. So now that this case has been decided, those will move forward. Arizona might be finally set on its districts just about the time it gets to draw new ones.
And I would just say, Joshua, two great little nuggets of news out of this today. The first one is the guy in the middle for the whole court, and that's obviously the focus of this hour, talking about the court's term, as it has been for years, is Anthony Kennedy, the native of California, native of Sacramento, who has a great backstory in redistricting because – or actually, I should say, rather, in writing initiatives, because he wrote an initiative for Ronald Reagan when Ronald Reagan was governor about taxes in California. And it's the way Reagan and Kennedy got their orbits aligned that, of course, Reagan appointed Kennedy to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1987. So he was the only guy who understands the initiative process ruling today. And the other thing is you feel like you could see the jabs that the court has had on all these other cases this term in the ruling today. John Roberts, the Chief Justice, wrote the dissent in this redistricting case, where he jabs at the majority about that they, you know, are instituting this brand new power and just making things simple and ignoring the Constitution. Why go through the hassle of writing a new part of the U.S. Constitution when you can just do this? And you feel that back and forth that we have seen in all these other cases play out in one of these final cases of the term here on Political Map Drawing.
Speaking of the other cases, we should get to those. And yes, there has been a lot of jousting this term, and you can a lot of it has kind of come out very much in the text of the decisions, and this one was no different. That's KQED's California Politics and Government editor, John Myers. John, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And John will be back with us in the next hour to talk about California's vaccine bill, which is pending today. Also, Loyola Law School professor Justin Levitt joining us on the line. Professor, thanks for talking to us.
You bet. Thanks very much.
Let's continue the conversation now about the U.S. Supreme Court's term with Marcia Coyle. She is the chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal. She was at the court today, and she is the author of The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. Marcia, good morning.
Good morning. A lot of struggling going on this last week and this week.
Yes, indeed. And we're going to get to that in just one second. Also here with me in studio is Professor Rory Little of the UC Hastings College of the Law. Professor Little, good to see you.
Nice to see you. Thank you for having me.
We also welcome your questions and your thoughts as we continue exploring these big decisions. Please feel free to call us, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. Marcia Coyle, let me start with you with regards to this lethal injection decision. First of all, explain the controversy over this decision. As I understand, it had to do with this three-drug cocktail that some states use, and specifically the very first drug in that array, the anesthetic, right?
Right, exactly. The drug is supposed to render the inmate unconscious. And unconscious long enough so that the final two drugs, which ultimately will kill him or her, are administered. But, you know, the states have been having a very difficult time getting the drugs that they need for a lethal injection. A number of companies that manufactured them, primarily in Europe, have balked at supplying them for execution. So states like Oklahoma, where this case came from, have turned to alternatives. And the alternative for that first drug in their three-drug cocktail is midazolam. Midazolam was used in several executions that resulted in, you might call them botched executions. In one case, the inmate was actually awake and said that there was something wrong going on. In two other executions, the inmate either gasped for a lengthy period of time or it took almost 20 minutes for the inmate to ultimately die. So there's been a lot of controversy about this particular drug. The case that came to the Supreme Court, I have to tell you, there were two clues to how this case was actually going to come out.
Actually, before we get to those two clues, yeah. And I do want you to mention that, I think we should be clear. The concern was not just that the anesthetic did not work, but that because the anesthetic did not work, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the sensation that the prisoners would feel was akin to being burned alive from the inside out. Is that
That's
right? This
correct.
Is not just like you feel your life slipping away from you and it's like it just takes a longer time for you to slip away. This is supposedly like 45 minutes of basically feeling like you're being burned at the stake.
That's correct, and that's how it's been characterized and was characterized during the oral arguments in the Supreme Court. So the concern was that the use of midazolam as the first drug was going to violate the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. When the case came to the Supreme Court, at first it was brought by four Oklahoma death row inmates, and they were asking, one, for a stay of execution, two, they filed a petition for review with the Supreme Court to consider their constitutional claim. Well, you need five votes to get a stay of that execution, and there were not five votes. Only four justices voted to stay the execution. One of the four inmates was then executed fairly quickly, but when it comes to reviewing full arguments, briefing in the Supreme Court on a petition for review, you only need four votes. And although we don't know who the four were, it's probably a pretty good guess that the court took the case because of the four votes who had originally wanted to issue a stay of execution but lost that particular motion. So there was your first clue that there were at least five justices on the court who really didn't want this case, who felt that the lower court was correct in finding that there was no constitutional problem with the use of midazolam. So then we come to the oral arguments. And I have to tell you that they probably were some of the most contentious arguments that I have heard all year, and even in recent years. Right out of the bat, Justice Alito, who ended up writing the majority opinion today, said to the lawyer representing the death row inmates, "Let's be frank about why we're here." And he said it was because of the guerrilla war waged by the anti-death penalty attorneys around the country, that they were responsible for causing the problems that states were having in getting hold of proper drugs for lethal injection.
You know what, Marshall, let me pause you there for just 1 second. I'm sorry. I want to pause you there and bring in Professor Rory Little on that point in terms of the contentiousness of these arguments and what Marsha just said in terms of anti-death penalty advocates pressuring companies that make these drugs to not make them available for these purposes. I imagine that that's kind of that the way the oral arguments went for this case was pretty much in line with that whole controversy, that the contentiousness outside the court spilled right over into it and became a much larger issue than just does this drug hurt or not.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, Marsha's done a great job of setting this case out. You know, Justice Alito said, come on, we know what's going on here. It's a guerrilla warfare against the death penalty, at which point Justice Kagan responded, hey, this is like being burned alive from the inside. This is not just skirmishing. And today's announcement, and Marsha may have been in the courtroom, my understanding is one of the most dramatic announcements of an opinion, because two of the justices, Breyer and joined by Ginsburg, said they're now convinced that the death penalty may well be unconstitutional in all contexts. There hasn't been sitting—
Wait, back up. They said that they were convinced that the death penalty is inherently unconstitutional.
That's
right. No matter how you carry it out.
That's right, yes. Which they haven't— There hasn't been sitting justices saying that since Brennan and Marshall left the court 20-some years ago— although Justice Blackmun and Stevens kind of said the same thing on the way out. Very dramatic, though, because you had, I think, four justices today, maybe five, reading their opinions, sort of majority, dissent, concurring, another dissent. I mean, my understanding is that – and it took over half an hour to announce this case. So the same kind of bitter controversy is on the court today. And what's really interesting about this is next fall they've already got four cases on the docket that raise certain issues about the death penalty. And boy, the pressure right now on Justice Kennedy, who's that fifth vote, has got to be huge. And remember, he spent the last couple days being insulted by his conservative brethren on this issue. So – next fall, you're going to see fireworks on the death penalty.
But Marsha, apparently, I mean, the fireworks are there for sure. But it seemed like the justices, at least based on the way the majority opinion was written, were not convinced by the arguments about whether or not midazolam was a reasonable alternative, whether or not the prisoners had proven that the drug really was a problem. I mean, it seemed like though this is an issue, they weren't persuaded by that.
Well, that's exactly right. Justice Alito's opinion had two parts, and that one part is involving how midazolam actually operates. He said that the evidence in the lower court when they had the hearings on this did not support the death row inmates' claims that it was ineffective to render the inmates insensate. And Justice Sotomayor did respond to that when she read her dissent from the bench. She said that the state's expert witness testimony represented a complete misunderstanding of the science and had been contradicted by very reputable scientists, and even the state had admitted later that the testimony of the expert was somewhat unreliable. So she said that midazolam is the chemical equivalent of being burned at the stake. There was a second problem, too, that the majority found with the death row inmates' arguments. For the first time, the court said that if a death row inmate is going to challenge a method of execution, that inmate also has to come forward with a constitutional alternative. And that's new. And Justice Sotomayor said that that's the legal and more serious error that the majority did. She said she called it surreal.
That seems like a very high bar for a prisoner to have to clear.
Absolutely. She said that no matter how barbaric the method of execution may be, it will be constitutional unless the inmate can identify an alternative. And that is really the first time I've heard that kind of requirement imposed in a death penalty case.
You know, we're coming up on the break. I do want us to have more time to discuss this as well. And, of course, to you listening in, please feel free to ask whatever questions and thoughts you may have about this, the redistricting decision. And we're going to talk about the EPA pollution regulations decision on the other side of the break. Professor Rory Little, how does this affect California? I mean, we have an ongoing controversy over lethal injection in this state. I don't believe we used the same drug that was at issue here. Oklahoma used to use the same drug as California uses, and the one they switched to that is at issue is different from ours. But briefly, before we go to break, how does this affect us?
Well, in a sense, that's why this really is skirmishing on this precise issue. We don't use this drug, but the California death penalty has been stayed, I think, by three different courts now at three different levels. There hasn't been an execution in California in many years, and nobody thinks one's going to happen too soon. It really has to do with, are we going to have capital punishment at all in this country is sort of the big issue.
All right. Well, we will continue this conversation on the other side of the break. Much more to discuss with UC Hastings Law Professor Rory Little. And we have to say goodbye to Marcia Coyle of the National Law Journal. Marcia, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Take care now.
You too. Thank you. We'll continue our conversation about the end of the U.S. Supreme Court's term. Please feel free to chime in with your questions and your thoughts. 866-733-6786 or email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News. Glad to be with you today. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're continuing our conversation on the major rulings that ended the U.S. Supreme Court's latest term. We're speaking with UC Hastings Law School Professor Rory Little, and I want to welcome to the program Michael Doyle of the McClatchy Newspapers. Michael, glad to have you with us.
Glad to be with you.
And we certainly welcome your questions and your thoughts. Feel free to call us, 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. And feel free to post your comments online. Go to kqed.org/forum. Michael Doyle, let me start with you in reviewing this case regarding the EPA's new air pollution regulations. This centered, as I understand it, around these long-awaited, very hotly debated rules on how we regulate air pollutants, including mercury. What's the backstory?
Well, that's right, but it actually the battle starts before the regulations are even proposed. The question is when you have to do a cost-benefit analysis. The Environmental Protection Agency is told under the Clean Air Act that cost-benefit analyses must be part of a necessary, must be required if they're considered to be necessary and appropriate. And the question is whether the EPA was correct in saying that a cost-benefit study was not necessary in making the threshold decision of whether to regulate.
So I just want to be—I want to make sure we're clear. The law says, the Clean Air Act says, that the EPA has some discretion to determine if a cost-benefit analysis is warranted in one case or another. Is that it?
The law leaves up to the EPA to determine what is necessary.
Gotcha.
Before it imposes regulations. The Bush administration EPA said a cost-benefit study is not necessary. The Obama administration EPA says, no, it is necessary. The challengers in the form of industry in certain states challenged the EPA, and in the 5-4 decision today, the court said, no, especially when you take into account the billions of dollars in cost, the EPA must first determine whether how much it'll cost before they decide whether regulation's needed.
What kinds of costs are we talking about? Millions? Billions? How much money is at stake?
A lot of money. $9.6 billion a year in compliance costs and construction and implementation is the standard estimate. And Justice Antonin Scalia, the conservative who wrote the majority opinion, said that far outstrips any health benefits that might be accrued. So it's whether or not the $9.6 billion is just an approximation or not, it's an order of magnitude more than the benefits, according to the critics.
Professor Rory Little, why is cost such a factor in this matter? I mean, you can't put a price on the value of the Earth. It's our only home. Shouldn't money be no object?
Well, money is going to be an object. If you have no benefit and it costs billions to comply, maybe we don't do it. This case is a little bit of a tempest in a teapot because the statute says the EPA has to determine whether it's appropriate and necessary to regulate an industry. Once they decide that it is appropriate and necessary, then they have to do cost-benefit analysis. So the only question is, do they have to consider those costs at the very first step, or is it okay if they just wait till the second, third, fourth, ninth step? There's no doubt they would consider costs sooner or later. And how you measure benefit is very controversial. But here, the idea was it would be a $30 billion benefit for the $9 billion of compliance. So that sounds like it's worth it.
Then I imagine this is for an industry that is making many more billions of dollars than 9.6. I mean, presumably they would be able to afford, although I don't know. I mean,
people argue
the cost structure is.
People argue about the utilities. Are they making a lot of money, or are they regulated so heavily by the state that they're not allowed to profit? We all sort of know what we think about PG&E locally. Justice Kagan says in her dissent, and it's 5-4, she says, this really is silly because they're going to consider costs all the way down the line. So all this does is remands it back to the EPA. They then have to say, well, is there appropriate and necessary regulation here considering costs? And then once they say, yes, there is, which they almost certainly will, they'll go forward. The coal and oil-powered utility industry, which is in 34 states, is a multi-billion dollar industry, and that's why they're fighting here. They're saying, boy, it costs us a lot to comply.
Mike?
I would like to say Professor Little is, of course, absolutely right when pointing out that it is controversial and complicated to figure benefits. And here's an example. Justice Scalia cites benefits of only $4 to $6 million a year by controlling emissions, which sounds extraordinarily low, but that's the ratio that Justice Scalia uses to justify his conclusion that the costs of regulation far outweigh the benefits.
I'm still struggling with this idea of cost-benefit. I have to admit, I mean, granted, I'm not steeped in the Clean Air Act, so maybe you know better about this than I do, but there's benefits and there's benefits. There's the extrinsic benefits that are based on the bottom lines of Wall Street corporations, and then there are the intrinsic benefits of having breathable air. And I wonder, Michael Doyle, if you know how the law balances those. I mean, it seems like in this case, the economic benefit won the day, when potentially the cost, the economic cost of doing this, would have been far outweighed by the environmental benefit of having breathable air. What does the law say about how we balance those things?
Well, that's the question. The law, in the case of oil and coal-fired power plants, is a little bit ambiguous. And returns us to that necessary and appropriate question. I agree with Professor Little that there is a little bit of a tempest in a teapot aspect to this, because the Obama administration and EPA will clearly determine on what's called remand that, yes, the costs do justify regulating. And the law does require, once the decision to regulate is made, the regulations themselves must take into account cost as well, and as well as the benefits of avoided deaths and avoided illnesses and so on.
Michael, does the EPA get another chance to remake these regulations, or are they pretty much dead?
Oh, my gosh. These regulations will never be in the process of completion, as far as I can tell.
They'll live forever.
They'll be proposed, promulgated, opposed, litigated, and re-proposed for years to come. This has been more than a decade in the works, and there's no prospect of an end in sight. But certainly the EPA, my understanding is the EPA will now go back and make the threshold decision that taking costs into account.
Professor Little, California rallied behind the EPA in this case. How does today's ruling affect states like California that are very assiduous and very aggressive about regulating major polluters now more than ever?
Well, you know, it's easier to regulate in a stringent way if you're a state, if you have the backing of the federal EPA doing it on a national level. In effect, a utility isn't going to say, I'm leaving California because it's too expensive, if they're going to face the same regulations all around. You know, your question about how do you figure out costs raises two very important issues, which is why this case is even more important. How far should courts defer to administrative agencies? That's been a question on the table since the New Deal. And that was a question here. If EPA says they can interpret the statute this way, shouldn't the courts defer? 5-4, the court said no. There was a global warming case a few years ago that went 5-4 in the other direction, Massachusetts versus EPA, where the justices debated what are the costs of global warming. And the truth is, no one is quite sure. Some people say it doesn't exist. So this is a very complicated issue, and the courts are asked to intervene in a sense without expertise, but with a fair amount of authority and trying to keep it in check with both the statutes and then ultimately the Constitution.
So really the court's not answered this question about how we balance these calculable costs versus the incalculable costs of, you know, we don't know what the cost of higher mercury pollution will be in the air 40 years from now. The only way to find out is to leave it and measure then. And then the court really hasn't figured out how we democratically parse that.
Well, and I would say Mike is exactly right that the administrations can change. So one administration says, here's how we're going to figure out costs. And the next administration say, no, we're going to roll it back and figure out a different way. So there is a political, if you will, ideological component to this. It's one of the many reasons your presidential election is important, because they're going to select who's in charge of all the agencies that do impose costs on industry. If you're a small business and you've got to comply with some of these regulations, it could be very expensive.
Go ahead, Michael.
One small point, building off of what Professor Little said in terms of court's deference, what court watchers know as Chevron deference, there's a very interesting concurring opinion by Justice Clarence Thomas, who says, you know what, we should reconsider this whole notion of courts deferring to an executive agency's reasonable interpretation of an ambiguous statute. For those interested in where Justice Thomas is on the court and how much he doubts the rightness of an executive interpretation, you should look at his concurring opinion.
Can we make the ironic point that Justice Thomas says, let's reconsider deference to agencies, but in same-sex marriage, he says we should defer to the states?
Oh, no, we're not going to make that ironic point. We do want to get to a few responses, and then I swear we're going to go to your calls and emails. Thank you all so much for being so very patient. We got a response from Laura Sheehan. She is a spokesperson for the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. It's a coal industry-backed group. And she said she is hopeful that EPA's massive mission creep will be subject to the scrutiny it deserves and stricken down by the judiciary in the future. future. Anna Aurelio, who's the Washington director of Environment America, said in a statement that the court's decision to let polluters off the hook is a huge setback for our kids' health. One of our listeners, Will, wrote us by email, "The corporate Supreme Court has voted 5-4 to make our air dirtier. This will affect far more people than the reapportionment decision." Let's get to some more of your calls and emails and tweets and Facebook posts, 866-733-6786. And this is about any of the decisions that we've discussed today, or, you know, if you have reactions about the Supreme Court's term. We do want to look back at the term overall and see what it means in context and what it will mean going forward. So please do share your thoughts with us. Let's begin with Milton in Oakland. Milton, good morning.
Hello. This is about the redistricting case. Clarify for me, please, the controversy over the definition of legislature. I always thought that it meant one thing and one thing only, the representatives the voters elect.
That's a good question. Professor Little, can you get into that a little bit further, why this word legislature was such a big deal?
Well, the question boils down to what did the framers intend when they said the time and manner and place shall be established by the state legislature. The framers started their document with the phrase, "We the people." And the theory of the people, or the framers, was the people establish their lawmaking process. So, for example, could a state tomorrow, by initiative, vote to disband its legislature? No more legislature. We'll just make all our laws by initiative. There's some question as to whether you could do that constitutionally, but this decision seems to say any mechanism that is lawfully chosen by the people to make their laws is going to count as the legislature of the state, and we're not going to be bound by today what we think is, as somebody put it, the people under the dome. It's a very fundamental and kind of simple almost constitutional question with very large implications.
Yes, and Chief Justice Roberts writes a very marked, emphatic dissent saying that the court's majority, written by Justice Ginsburg, has completely rewritten the meaning of the term legislature, that and to include the people as evidenced by voter initiative. And there may be a little bit of irony in this. This is Chief Justice Roberts, who, in the Affordable Care Act case of just a few days ago, read into the words "the state" the ability of the federal government to establish a health exchange. But in the redistricting case, Justice Roberts said this is expanding what the framers meant by legislature.
But this is kind of why we have a Supreme Court, isn't it? I mean, we have these large laws at the top, the Constitution, that speak to both the spirit of what we intend and the letter of what we intend. And there's all this room in the middle for interpretation. And over time, the interpretations change and evolve, I guess, as we change and evolve.
Yeah, that famous phrase from Chief Justice Marshall back in the early 1800s, Chief Justice Marshall having been a revolutionary soldier, Secretary of State under President Washington, an original framer in some sense. He says the duty of the court is to say what the law is after we've written the Constitution, after we've written a statute. So like it or not, that's what the court does. It tries to be cautious, but it's got to do the job.
Rosemarie in San Mateo wrote us via email, "If the Supreme Court had voted the other way, couldn't the California legislature have just voted to approve the district maps drawn up by the committee? They would not have to redraw, just approve the recommendation of an independent group?" Professor
Little? Absolutely. In fact, that's why I say it's kind of like avoiding a car crash. We don't know what would have happened if they decided the other way. A lot of people thought there would be good public pressure on the legislature to adopt the independent commission mechanism because people think it works so well. Three Republican governors, former governors of California, filed an amicus brief in defense of the independent commission because they said, boy, when we were governor, this was a terrible process. We would have preferred the independent process and we'd like it now.
Well, now there are a number of districts in California where it would have certainly been, you know, Democratic districts or Republican districts. But when we redistricted it, and also when we went to a top two primary system, it completely changed the game and it opened doors for candidates who never would have had a shot under the old system.
And in fact, back in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill, there were a lot of nervous Nelly lawmakers who thought the decision was going to go the other way. And enable not the state legislature to essentially re-ratify the independently drawn districts, but the Democrats in Sacramento, there was some fear, we're going to go hog wild and seize the opportunity to write new, more partisan, additionally Democratic districts, some of them particularly in the state's Central Valley. So it was there was a lot of anticipation that California's lines would change potentially dramatically.
Michael, expand on that a little bit. And I should roll back. I don't mean to say that a candidate would not have a chance. Every candidate has a chance. We never know how an election's going to go, so I don't want to sound presumptuous. But Michael, talk a little bit more about the point you just made. Were there lawmakers on Capitol Hill who were preparing to take action if the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled against this redistricting commission? Were people actually beginning to think that through, or was it more kind of an amorphous fear?
Right. Well, that was my question, too, and honestly, I've never gotten a full answer. I do know from my conversations with California members of Congress from both parties that they were thinking at the forefront of their political minds was the question of what the court would do, because honestly, following the oral arguments earlier this year, there seemed to be a lot of judicial skepticism, and there was some thought that California and Arizona would lose. There were definite conversations. I think the most serious conversations were in Sacramento, where the state legislators would have had the ultimate responsibility. But some very high-level California congressmen were talking to their counterparts in Sacramento.
Let's continue our conversation with a few comments from listeners. We got three very strongly worded comments about the death penalty decision. One listener writes, "When will we get it? The most compelling moral argument against the death penalty is that the people represented by the state should not model or exemplify the very behavior we say we're trying to deter. One can't have it both ways with moral consistency. Furthermore, with the death penalty, we kill with premeditation in the extreme, whereas most violence is a crime of passion and the moment." Another listener writes, "Just last week you did a show on drugs that are being smuggled into prison that are killing people. Apparently, inmates like these drugs. Lots of them are sitting in evidence rooms. Why are we not using them?" And another listener writes, "This may be very ignorant, but when I've had to euthanize a pet, the vet administers a gentle drug that literally makes it go to sleep. Why can't the states do something like this? Why not overdose them on heroin or morphine?" Professor Little, those sound a little terse, but they raise a worthwhile question which goes to the heart of this Eighth Amendment issue about cruel and unusual punishment. I mean, you could shoot somebody in the temple and they'd be dead instantly. But it's cruel and unusual.
Well, you know, this is the controversy, and Justice Scalia and Thomas both write very vituperative concurrences this morning, taking issue with Justice Breyer and Ginsburg on the cruel and unusual nature of the death penalty. Arguing about the method of execution is almost surreal. A number of states, anticipating that the court might not approve this one drug, already passed alternative statutes saying, you know what, if lethal injection is struck down, let's just go back to the firing squad, or let's just go back to hanging, which has been upheld as constitutional, or electrocution, which has been upheld. So the method of execution is almost not the issue. The first responder who said, boy, this is really just a basic moral issue. The hard part about that is there are certain aggravated cases where the American people overwhelmingly support the death penalty. When Timothy McVeigh killed 168 people in the Oklahoma City federal building with 32 children in the daycare center and he waved goodbye and blew them up, 87% of Americans said the day after that execution, we're in favor of his execution. At the same moment, 67% said they were in favor of the death penalty. That means 20% of the people said we're against the death penalty, but we're in favor of it for Timothy McVeigh. It's a hard issue.
And I also go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to say along those lines, as an example of the high emotions evinced by this, Justice Alito, in the majority opinion, cites in graphic detail the crimes for which the four original petitioners in this case, were convicted, namely raping an infant, beating someone to death with a baseball bat, and so on. Gruesome set of facts that really have nothing to do with the lethal injection chemicals at stake, but seemingly designed to explain why the society has every right to put some people to death.
Let's continue now on the phones with Justice in San Antonio. Justice, good morning.
Hello.
What's on your mind, Justice?
It's more along the lines of the the cruel and unusual punishment part of it. You know, thinking about it, they put them, they got themselves in that position of being on death row. You know, normally by murder, there's been other cases where it's not necessarily the case, but most of them are from murder. So why does it matter how they go out? I mean, you know, they had done something cruel and unusual to get themselves into that position. So, you know, it's kind of like an eye for an eye type thing.
Okay. I hear you. Justice, thanks for the comment. Let's continue on the phones now with Wynn in Menlo Park. Wynn, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I believe I must be naive because I grew up believing that if you took nine people, tried and true, and put them on the Supreme Court, they could interpret what's going on in the Constitution and how the world should run. And ever since 2000, when the court took on the Gore v. Wade case, when I don't believe the Constitution gave them the right to do it, all the rulings seem to be confusing more so than ever. Am I being naive to believe that there is an answer to questions that go to the Supreme Court, and nine people should be able to find them, not vituperatively or with five to four votes all the time?
That's a good question, Wynn, and that's the second time we've used the word vituperative in this hour. I'm very proud of our SAT skills today. But he raises a good question. I mean, ever since Bush v. Gore, I think that's what he meant. I think he said Gore v. Wade, but Bush v. Gore in 2000 that resolved the 2000 presidential election. I'm a Floridian, so I will never forget that night. It does seem like some of these issues should be able to be more cut and dried. But Professor Little, you know, America's not a cut and dried kind of country.
You know, you can take the long view historically. Boy, in the 1930s, the Supreme Court was probably more divided than the current court on different issues, which is how could we get ourselves out of this unbelievable economic depression, the likes of which we've never seen before or since. Frankly, the president said, you know what, I think I'll just expand the court to 15 justices because I'm tired of these nine justices who can't agree and 5-4 are striking down all of the bills. Bush versus Gore, I think everyone views that case as an anomaly, and I think the justices themselves regret it, and they've never cited it since then, either side, because they don't believe that it was well considered. They took the case in a matter of days rather than months, which is what they usually take. You know, the issues are harder maybe as we get more and more populated and more regulated.
More and more diverse as a country.
More and more diverse, right? The social concerns, the diversity. Same-sex marriage wasn't on the table at the time of Bush versus Gore, really.
Well, but that's true. But I'm looking at the invaluable SCOTUS blog site right now, and it reminds me that of the decisions decided this year, 43% have been decided on a 9-0 basis. Now, these are cases that nobody cares about because they're pretty boring. And an additional 6% were decided 8-1. So even though our attention, understandably, is focused on the closely divided cases, the most incendiary and, if you will, vituperative among them, this court still is able to decide a lot of cases on a majority, but on a unanimous basis.
You know, Mike, before we end the hour, and we're running out of time this hour, would you say a quick word about some of the cases that are coming up next session, particularly this case on affirmative action that justices decided to take in the session to come?
Right. Talk about Groundhog Day. This is the Fisher versus Texas. Fisher is Abigail Fisher, who at the time of the original complaint was applying to or had recently been rejected by the University of Texas, a white female. She complained about the Texas admissions program. In the long years since, she's graduated from Louisiana State, but the case lives on. Put briefly, in 2012, the Supreme Court, in a narrow decision, said Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals reconsider this case. Fifth Circuit reconsidered it. Now this is back. It does give the opportunity for the court next term, starting in October, to reconsider its acceptance or not of race as a consideration in university admissions. At this point, it may be the highest profile case of the new term.
Professor Little, do we expect – I mean, California has dealt with the affirmative action issue before historically. This doesn't have any direct – connections or effects to California potentially, does it?
No. The court is heavily divided, 5-4, on whether affirmative race-conscious remedies are ever appropriate. And this case will, again, force them to confront it. Kennedy will be the center. There are other cases on the docket. There's a lot of death penalty on the docket next term. There's a one-person, one-vote case, which is could be very important for the court.
Is that aimed at the kind of Citizens United issues behind who has the power in elections?
I don't know that it's a Citizens United case. It's more when you're redistricting, can you create districts that don't have one person, one vote? What does that mean exactly? Do they have to be mathematically perfectly even, or how far can they deviate? But again, it's an important redistricting case.
It is, and that's one that Californians are watching very closely. It could really affect districts in the state's Central Valley that have large number of undocumented immigrants as residents.
Finally, Michael, before we end the hour, what do you make of this term overall? Briefly, what are your overall impressions?
Groundbreaking term, landmark. And here's the thing about it. At the start of the term back in October, there was no certainty what cases were going to be on the docket. They didn't have the same-sex marriage case docketed yet. I don't recall that they had the Affordable Care Act case. I don't think they had the death penalty case. And it's just proof once again that you never really know what a term – it's like a box of chocolates, right? You just never know what the term is going to offer up until it's completed.
And Professor Little, overall impressions?
Well, overall, I do think the court issued more decisions that move in a leftward direction than they've done in recent terms. I think Justice Kennedy is reaching a high level of maturity and confidence. He was insulted by his brethren over the last week. The summer is a chance to calm down, but we're going to see if this continues next term.
Oh, do you really think they're going to calm down this summer, or are they just going to save it up?
They're going to save it up.
They're going to save it up. Professor Rory Little of UC Hastings College of the Law. Rory, we always appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Michael Doyle covers the U.S. Supreme Court from McClatchy Newspapers. Michael, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Laubert, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. We get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News. Thank you so much for listening. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.